Welcome to Modern Sign Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. When our guest today writes about firearms in his highly popular Nathan McBride action series, he knows intimately what he's talking about. Not only is Andrew Peterson an excellent writer, he is an excellent shot as well. He holds the classification of master in the NRA's high-power rifle ranking system. He's written that he and his friends would shoot out to 1,000 yards with match-condition M1As and M1 Garands without using optics, only iron sights. His familiarity with weapons and dedication to research has resulted in many speaking engagements and we think adds an extra dimension of believability to his writing. His latest in the Nathan McBride series is Right to Kill, and we're very pleased to welcome Andrew Peterson. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, delighted. You know, I'm always fascinated with personal backstory, particularly if somebody didn't set out from the beginning to be a writer. And you actually have a degree in architecture. How did that transition from that or whatever else we were doing before to being a published author take place for you?
Well, Roger, it's not a long story. It's interesting in the sense that I read a lot as a kid. I was one of those kids that was always into reading. I think my folks were always trying to get me to go outside and play, but I preferred reading. I liked Ray Bradbury and the science fiction writers, and I continued to read all through college, although I didn't have as much time to read in college. I tried to get some reading in whenever I could, and then after I graduated, I started my career, worked in an architectural firm, and I did some real estate development. But I was always still reading, and I think I was, must have been about 20 years ago, and I was reading a book and kind of complaining about it. My wife goes, "Well, if you think you can do a better job, why don't you write one?" And I said, "Carla, I'll take that challenge." And I did. I set out to write a novel, and I got to tell you, Roger, when I finished, it was just absolutely dreadful. This thing was so bad that burning it would have been an insult to fire. It was just that bad. But I think it's a lot like oil painters. When they first start in a profession, their early works are not going to be, you know, as quality as when they move on, I think. So that's really how I got into writing. I found that it was a lot more challenging than I thought. It's not just a matter of putting words on a page. There's a whole system and a method to do it.
I understand that you had a mentor in the form of Ridley Pearson.
I did. Yeah, he was awesome. I wrote as a hobby writer for a long time. I think about 15 years. I just kind of wrote on the side. I wasn't really serious about it. And I realized that if I'm going to do this and really, you know, make a living at it and try to sell some books, then I need to learn this craft. And the way I did that was I looked up writers' conferences, and that's advice I give to all writers that talk to me about it, is what can I do? And I said, always go to writers' conferences. Everything you need to know is at these conferences. And I met Ridley Pearson on the 2005 Alaskan cruise put on by the Maui Writers. And he was just an amazing person, very friendly, very knowledgeable, very encouraging. And he recommended that I contact his freelance editor, a gentleman named Ed Stackler. And that really was a pivotal point in my career because Ed Stackler turned out to be very influential in my writing. He knew agents and editors at publishing houses. And so everything kind of hinges back to that decision to go to writers' conferences and that. And again, Ridley was wonderful. I met John Saul, another author, and Susan Wiggs, who writes kind of romantic suspense. So there was kind of a nice cross-section of different, you know, fiction authors on this cruise. And I think the encouragement was probably the most important thing is, you know, don't be discouraged. It takes a long time. Nobody learns this right away, and nobody, you know, writes a New York Times bestseller their first time out. So just hang with it, and that was probably the best advice I got.
Mm-hmm. Great. I want to back up a little bit and talk a bit about your shooting because that's fascinating to me. You said mm-hmm. that you learned to make exact wind corrections, which you call the hardest part of long-distance marksmanship, because basically you have to predict the unpredictable, which is kind of a metaphor for life in a way, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, that's right. Gravity, of course, is a constant. So gravity does not change. So your bullet fall is something that's very predictable. Now, when you're shooting uphill, downhill, it's a little trickier. But when you're making a level shot, it's pretty much the same. It's an interesting fact of physics that if you were to fire a rifle at a very long, level surface like a desert, and you drop the rifle at the same time the bullet leaves the end of the barrel, the rifle and the bullet will hit the ground at the same time. So knowing that means that as the time of the bullet flight is really its bullet drop. So when you think about how far a bullet is going to drop because of the pull of gravity is really how long it's in the air. Now, wind is a little bit different because wind can change. It can swirl. It can change direction. It can go up and down. And so the great difficulty in long-distance shooting is really making the correct wind calls. And what we would do is when we were shooting out at long distances, we would take our spotter scope that we had right next to us, and we would focus on our targets, which might be 600 yards away, and then kind of focus about halfway down the range so that the targets became blurred. But what we could see was the mirage. And, you know, the mirage like you'd see out on a desert highway, and it kind of looks like ribbons in the air. And so you can see, if the ribbon's moving to the right, it kind of may be an upward angle, and then you fire a shot and you look at it, and then it's a little bit more level, so there's a little bit more wind, so you can make an adjustment that way. But it's something you learn to do. It's like golfing when you need to make that great shot when you've got to, you know, pitch it high over a bunker, land it on a short green and get close to the hole. It's something you just have to practice. So there's really no substitute for just shooting a lot. I think it's something you have to do to really learn the craft. Yeah, it's not magic. It's just something that you learn through experience, I think.
What is it? The guy says the 10,000 hours you need to get to expert level and whatever it is that you're doing.
Roger, it's probably a pretty good statement.
Yes.
You know, it's you think about these Marine Corps and Army shooters. They have so many more variables than we did shooting at just a static, you know, rifle range. It's unbelievable the kind of factors that go into those shots they make, especially at the super long distances. So there's a skill level with those guys that's far above me. We were precision shooters. You know, we were looking at, you know, quarter inch adjustments at, you know, long distances. But they have a little bit more leeway when they're just trying to make a hit on a silhouette. But it's still an amazing skill, in my opinion. Those guys are really a special breed of warrior.
And that's why you made Nathan a Marine sniper.
I did. Well, it was something I understood. I understood the mechanics of shooting, and I thought, well, what can I do with this that would be interesting? Well, I can make him a sniper. And then to make it even more interesting, I made him an officer, because very few, if any, you know, Marine shooters are officers. They're mostly enlisted. And I gave him a kind of a colorful background, one that is kind of quite dramatic. He had very bad time after a mission. He got captured and was treated very brutally for a few weeks before he was rescued. So he's got some baggage, but he's an interesting character to me. He seems almost too real at times. He's a little scary, Roger, because you know, he's a fictional character, but he seems so real to me. And I guess I struggle with that. I don't like to, I guess one of the things as authors have to do is they kind of have to torment their characters. They can't really give them smooth sailing very often. So it's hard to do with somebody that you like.
One of the things authors tell me often is that they start writing something and they're going a direction with a particular story arc, mm-hmm. and they realize that their characters would never do that. The characters basically tell them, I can't do that. And so you change.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think one of when someone's writing in the thriller genre, it's a genre that you have to be careful with, because although the reader expects there to be action and violence and some killing, you can't go overboard with it. I mean, when you think about James Bond, I mean, how bad does James Bond feel about killing anybody? He really doesn't, right? It's just kind of like part of his deal. But Nathan is a man of conscience, and he's conflicted, and he really doesn't like doing that. And so it takes a chunk out of him. And so when you factor that into his background and his personality, that yes, he was treated very brutally, but he still has a heart. He's a good person, and I think he does it out of necessity, not out of any sort of joy Does that make sense, Roger?
It absolutely does. And it makes him a much more interesting and complex character. I mean, one of the things you talk about in this book is the anger that constantly churned his soul, as you put in it, or the pure rage, dark entity inside him that he has to control that helped him survive that horrible torture. But he has to watch out that doesn't come out too much.
Yeah, that's right. It's something that's just below the surface, and he's aware that it exists, and sometimes he'll tap into it. It's like when he really gets into a very tight situation, he just has to, go the animal, trapped animal, route.
Right.
We all have a very tough part of our soul, and I don't think I don't know your background, but I've never faced mine. I don't know just what I'm capable of, and I hope I'm never tested.
Yeah,
but Nathan was. I mean, he really was. And so this part of his soul came forward and kind of helped him through some of the worst, parts of when he was, being tortured, which is, it's hard to imagine. It's part of the difficulty of writing this character, because I don't like delving into that, but it really is who he is, and I can't gloss over it. It's not something that you can just sugarcoat. I guess that's part of the difficulty in writing, that part of the story, is that it hurts me to hurt him.
Yeah, but it's necessary in a way. And the interesting thing about it is you've written that he's the same character in Right to Kill, which is the current book, as he was in First to Kill, which was the first one. The reader learns new things about him, but he hasn't changed who he is. That's very interesting.
Well, it's part, if you think about the Jack Reacher character, Lee Child's character, he is Reacher. I mean, he's Reacher in the killing floor as he is in the 19th or 18th book. He's the same character. Now, the reader gets more familiar with him and learns more about him, but his core is the same. So, I mean, Nathan is not going to get married, settle down, and have kids. It's not something that I don't necessarily know that the readers would accept that about him. I think they expect him to, be a certain way and to act a certain way and to deal with certain situations, in the way that he is. So it's one of those things that makes it challenging as a writer. Yes, he's the same character, but how do you keep it fresh? How do you let people know what his background is without, cookie cutting from one book to the other? So there's ways to do it, but it makes it definitely more challenging. And it's easier in the sense that I don't have to invent new characters for each book. They're the same character. But letting the reader know what their story is where the challenge becomes. Because they're action-driven novels. I don't spend a lot of time just telling the reader about who they are. They actually learn who they are through what he does and what he says.
Exactly. And show, don't tell, as they say. That's the,
It's a great expression, Roger. It's really, I take it to heart. It's actually one of the little notes I have hanging on my computer. It reminds me that I've got to keep, the tension and the action going in the books.
And you are magnificent at that. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed Right to Kill, which I will admit is my first exposure to him, and I'm now of course there goes the rest of my free time, because I have to go back and write all the other ones we did before. Thank you so much for that.
Well, Roger, it's my job. If I can keep you turning pages, that's what it's all about. And it's interesting, in Right to Kill, I kind of challenged myself. I wanted to do a novel that was different from the others in the sense that it is basically one continuous action scene. From the call to action at the very beginning, where Nathan and Harvey, respond to the situation, to the wrap-up, is a six-hour time period. So it's about 80-some-odd thousand words in a six-hour time period. So it's not what I would call a super complex novel as far as plot goes, but it's an entertaining read in the sense that I just keep my foot on the gas pedal and try to keep the action at a very high level.
Yeah. I love the way it sets up. And I think you had me from like page one, because the very first thing, I don't want to give any major plot points away, but what happens basically is this retired CIA station chief, Linda Genican, has a team of commandos. They're highly armed, coming after her. What sets the thing off is she's got the triple alarm wired not to make a big noise, but to shake her bed. And I'm thinking, that's so obvious, but I've never heard that before. And I'm thinking, well, there you go.
Well, it's one of the things that she'd always told herself that anybody ever came after her from her past, she'd deal with them, you know, because, I mean, you can't, most people don't realize that when you are facing a home invasion like that, you don't have the luxury of waiting for the police to arrive. You've got to deal with that. I mean, so she would rather have her alarm silent so that the bad guys don't know that she knows, kind of. So it also adds a little bit of tension to the story, I think. It kind of levels the playing field. I mean, I hope I never face a home invasion. It's be a very frightening thing. And so I thought, what could I write about that would be very frightening to a lot of people? How about some bad guys armed with all kinds of machine guns coming to your house?
That'll wake you up really good. Yes, and it did. And of course, it also, in this case, it sends a silent alarm off to Nathan, and he grabs Harvey and heads there. Of course, he can't get there right away. There's an amazing scene there, and a whole bunch of stuff happens, and it triggers some connections they've had to missions that they've done in the past. That's why they're after her. So without giving away more of the plot, let me tell you, this is a breakneck, got to know what happens, stay up to 2 a.m. and finish the dang thing. Yes, you have done well on this one. So,
well, thank you. I worked really hard on those scenes. Some of those action scenes are very, very tight, especially when I'm switching POVs and, you know, point of view.
Yeah.
So when you do that, I kind of have to back up like a couple lines just so the reader understands, well, where are we in this particular scene when I'm in a new POV? It was challenging, but it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed writing those scenes.
Yeah, there are several major pitched battles, and I will say that much in it, that involve a lot of clever thinking, a lot of having to react very, very quickly and trying to make the right choices. Mm-hmm. Don't always make the right choices, but end up with a satisfactory conclusion. I will say that. Maybe that's something I want to say
about the book.
There's books that you finish and go, there's books that go, yeah, it feels very satisfying. That's one of that. And I want to single out the ending of it, which touches on a small incident that happens partway through the book and involves Nathan being really kind to someone. And it kind of is a contrast to all the other things he has to do.
It is. I think it really demonstrates the softer side of him. Without being forced, it's one of those things that oftentimes showing compassion to somebody who may not show it to you is a very good trait a human being can have. So when he faces that one situation that you're talking about, he makes the decision that I don't need to be brutal here. I've got it under control. Why not try to turn it around? Why not try to make a friend rather than an enemy? And so I think if more people did that, the world would probably be a better place.
Oh, amen to that. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's. But it's hard. It's really hard because you're caught up in the emotion of the moment and you're angry, you're mad, you know, and so it's like intellect over emotion, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Right. I want to bounce around a couple little bits and pieces from here and there because I took lots of notes and I love the stuff in there. Early on, you mentioned there's a John Wick reference and talking about the movie with Keanu Reeves there. Having to do with dogs. And I know that I have read that you have a pair of schnauzers just like Nathan does. Are they by any chance named Sherman and Grant too?
No, my dogs are females. His are males.
Oh.
And they're named Elsa and Lily.
Ah,
and okay. They're just, I tell you, giant schnauzers. It's a lot of dog, but boy, they're just a lot of fun. They're just great dogs. Very bullheaded, very stubborn. But they're sweet. They're just I think, Roger, pretty much all dogs can be very sweet, depending on how you raise them. But they're giants tend to have a kind of a reputation as being aggressive, but they're really not. I don't. It's kind of like the Rottweiler, you know, or the Doberman, you know, reputation. I think it really, as you would know, is, you know, you raise the dog the way you want it to be.
Right.
Yeah, so, but I love dogs. I've always had dogs. I can't imagine my life without dogs.
I somehow sense that as well. And, of course, in this case, Linda has dogs as well, too. And I think of shepherds, as I recall.
She's been a volunteer for the German Shepherd Rescue of Orange County. actually exists. And it was an interesting point that this character, Linda Jenikin, actually won an auction to be a character in the book. And that's how I came up with that name. And that's actually physically what she actually looks like. And
cool.
The money was donated to the rescue, the German Shepherd rescue. And so it was kind of a neat thing. I enjoyed doing that for her. She really enjoyed the book. You know, I had a great time reading about myself. I didn't live that life, but it sure was fun to read.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely was. Let's see, oh gosh, so many other places I want to mention. Oh, you had, you're very devoted to the people who put their lives on their line for the rest of us, people in the military, people in the police and fire and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask you about the Operation Thriller, too, where this 2011 USO tour that you took with Clive Cussler and Sandra Brown and Kathy Reichs and Mark Bowden. I just imagine the conversations on that plane ride must have been awesome.
Yeah, these are very interesting people. They're much bigger authors than I am. I mean, I think Sandra Brown has something like 80 New York Times best-selling books or something. I don't know, some crazy number like that. And, of course, everybody knows Clive Cussler. And Mark Bowden, of course, wrote Black Hawk Down. And I got to tell you a really funny story about that. We were heading out to Bagram to go out to a forward operating base on near the Pakistani border. I think it was forward operating base Gambari. And there's a helicopter warming up out on the tarmac. I nudged Mark. I go, look at that helicopter out there. And he goes, oh, no, it's a Black Hawk. And I go, Mark, how ironic would it be if you get shot down in that?
Well, thanks for planting that thought in his head, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he said. He goes, thanks, Andy, a lot. Well, I go, well, they're giving us flak jackets. We're okay, you know. It's, okay, asking about this. We're putting these things on. He goes, oh, well, you know, people do occasionally take pot shots at the helicopter. And I go, well, that's just wonderful. You know. By the way, it was, honestly, Roger, we felt very safe the whole time. We were escorted around by the Oklahoma National Guard, the Thunderbirds, and they were compact women warriors. Armed with M4s, you know, full on, they were warriors. I mean, they were our personal guards. They went everywhere with us, and I felt very safe. At no time did I ever feel in any danger at all from anyone. Of course, we didn't get out and interact with the Afghani people. You know, we were always inside military organizations or military locations. But it was a wonderful experience. I think I'd have to say overall that I liked the professional nature of our soldiers. They were just unbelievable. We never saw an unkempt uniform. They were all very professional, very polite, very interested. And we traveled halfway around the world to say thank you to them, and all they could do was thank us for coming over there. So it was a really rewarding situation. I think all of us would do it again in a heartbeat. It was just a, you know, and I think we can be really summed up in one sentence. I sleep well at night because they often don't. And I wish more people, you know, I guess I worry about the millennial generation somewhat, is that they just maybe don't really get it. You ever feel that way, Roger?
Well, I'm lucky my own kids are millennials, and they got the message from me. I did not have the chance to serve,
good.
But I understand people who do and appreciate them. So, but a lot of their contemporaries don't even think it's not on the horizon at all.
No, they have no concept of what the World War II vets went. I just came back from Honolulu. I went over there on a small writing retreat just to get some serious work done. I locked myself in a hotel room and just crammed out work. I wanted to be in a warm environment. And it happened to be during the Pearl Harbor celebration of the 75th anniversary.
Oh.
And I got delayed in the San Jose airport. Our plane was broken, and they had to get a different one. And so one of the people that was getting it on the plane was a Pearl Harbor survivor. And I walked up to him. I thanked him for his service. And we had like a four-hour layup waiting for them. And I sat and talked with this man for 3 hours. It was an amazing, amazing experience. Oh, I'm totally lucky. I couldn't believe it. You know, and rather than I said, tell me, Merle. His name was Merle Christensen. And he was on Ford Island. He was with the PBY squadron, one of the Catalina squadrons.
Yeah.
So, you know, would do the patrols. I go, tell me what it was like. You know, what was it like? And he just unloaded. He just told me all kinds of things. And he said that when the after the initial attack had come in, there were all kinds of sailors that were. He was on the island there, and they were swimming and trying to get to shore. And so he was wading into this oiled burning water, pulling these guys onto the shore. It's just an amazing stories. I couldn't.
Wow.
And so I sort of wonder if really that kind of sacrifice is truly appreciated by our young folks. I hope it is. And I'm so glad that you've taught your kids to appreciate that, because what we experience here as Americans isn't this way because of people didn't sacrifice. They did. And so it's an amazing, amazing experience talking with this man.
And what is it they say? If you don't understand history, you're condemned to repeat it. So
I think that's very true. I wonder if these people even know where Pearl Harbor is. If you were to ask the average millennial, can you tell me where Pearl Harbor is? I hope they could tell you.
That frightens me, because it's such a part of our background, having been born in the late 40s and grew up in the shadow of World War II and a father who served in the South Pacific. I guess maybe some of us are more attuned to that than others. But
Yeah, my father was an Army vet, served in, he didn't actually serve in the war, just after Korea. My uncle served under General Patton at the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow, those are credentials for you. Yeah.
Great guy. He just recently passed on, but it was a great career, and I think that's probably why I make Nathan McBride a military hero, because my heroes really aren't ball players or musicians or actors. They really are our veterans. Those people, yes, they're paid. They volunteer to do it, but it's a little bit different when you actually enter a war zone. I don't think many of them believe they'll actually end up fighting, but when they do, it's really a crazy situation, and they're out there doing their best.
Right, and without injecting too much politics in it, I just say we should treat them better when they get home. I'm hoping
that's going to happen. I hope that the VA gets a big overhaul, and that if we live in a society where illegal immigrants are getting better hospitalization and treatment than our vets, I think that you could say there's something wrong.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say that. We're so much fun talking with you. I should steer you back to what's going on with, I'm sure you're working on the next novel even as we speak, right?
I am, Roger. I don't have a name for it yet. It's book number 7. It is going to involve probably the southern border, have an element of that involved, mm-hmm. and maybe a coyote, coyotes that smuggle people back and forth. I'm working real hard on it. I think it's going to be launching around late October next year.
Cool.
So I'm working real hard on that. It's one of those challenges to keep it interesting.
Well, I'm going to tie you down with a promise to come back and talk to us about that when it comes out, if you could.
I would love to. Roger, you're just a very good host. I feel very comfortable talking with you. It's a pleasure, honestly. You're an easy person to talk to.
Well, it's my job to be, and I've done about I've done about 400 author interviews so far. So
you're doing a great job.
thank you so much. I want to mention also that you are a good friend of VJ Books and are happy to autograph for them, so that if somebody's interested in listening to this saying, wow, how can I get an autographed first edition, you know where to talk to.
That's right. Yeah, VJ's got how long have they been doing this now? For, gosh, 20 plus years, I would think. Maybe longer.
Well, they long enough to get it right. I think that's the thing.
Yeah, they've been working a long time. I've met John in Virginia at the Thriller Fest in New York City. They were just very nice people.
They are indeed, and I can testify to the same thing, having met them several times personally and want to continue our association. So anything I have not asked you about that you think your listeners, readers would love to know?
Well, the best place to get a hold of me, or if you wanted to find out more about me, is through my website. It's real easy to find. It's www.andrewpeterson.com. And in there, I've got my links to my social, my Facebook page and my Twitter. I wouldn't say I'm super active in those media, but I generally don't get on there and push my books out. It's more just an interaction with people that read the series and questions they have. And people can learn a little bit more about me and my background and where I came from. That's about it, I think.
I want to mention that when you go on there, make sure you scroll down through his blog until you get to where they have the trailer for Right to Kill, because it's really well done. And I appreciate
it. Oh,
well,
thank you.
Yeah. So
that's Sheila English of COS Productions did that. She specializes in doing book trailers. So if there's authors out there that want to have a trailer made, she's the one to consult for that. It's Sheila English of COS Productions. Just a fabulous job. I think she's done thousands of these things. She's very, very good at it.
Oh, all right. Oh, I just ran into two more things I want to ask you about very quickly. One is
sure.
that in that trailer, you say that I'm looking for my note here. Isn't that always the case when you're trying to find something quickly? Basically said when that when evil exists, then good people have the right to kill. Thus the title. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, people say, well, how can, you know, Nathan be a Christian and do what he does? And I go, well, you know, somebody has to do it. I mean, those boys that stormed the beaches of Normandy, they were Christian boys. I mean, somebody has to do it.
Here's the quote. No? Some evils give good men the right to kill. That's the line from the trailer.
It's an interesting concept. Do we really have the right to kill? I guess we do.
We could talk for another hour about that. But my final thing is to note the fact that your titles all have kill as the last word of them, and it's written very big, so you can actually spot them across a whole crowded bookstore. And that reminds me of a few other authors who use, you know, some sort of connection with all their titles, like John D. McDonald had colors in all of his titles, whereas Travis McGee.
The Amazon Publishing of Thomas and Mercer, their imprint, did a really good job branding the series so that it is kind of instantly recognizable. I mean, those covers are, so when you see those, you realize, oh, that's the Nathan McBride series. And I think it's a good tool to use. I really do.
It
makes them instantly recognizable.
That's right. And of course, the reflex option, well, I better buy that right now because I haven't read that one. So there you go.
Right. Well, that's the idea. And you know, the good thing about Amazon Publishing, Thomas and Mercer, is their price points are pretty reasonable. You don't have to pay $12.99 and $14.99 for an ebook. I think they're selling for $4.99 and $3.99. So it's a good price point. I think they resent having to pay so much for ebooks. I really do. It's, when you think about it, it's what are you really getting, an electronic file?
Yeah. So well, I've got
another subject we could talk a lot about.
Yes,
right?
Yes, indeed. I've got about 40 of them on my iPhone, so I'm both directions. I also have
there you go.
My favorite line is, "Of course, you don't have enough shelves for your books. If you did, you wouldn't be worth knowing." So there you go.
Yeah. What do you prefer, Roger? Do you like ebooks or do you like paper? Do you like to read paper?
I like or both of them. I like the fact that I can get an ebook right now, if I have to have it. But there's nothing like sitting in there in a chair and reading it as a book that you can put down and don't need electronic assistance for. So that's what.
Yeah,
I like.
There's pluses and minuses to both for sure.
Absolutely. You know, you have been such a great guest. I really appreciate you taking the time, and you've been very generous with your time with us this morning. Our guest has been Andrew Peterson. His latest Nathan McBride novel is Right to Kill. Highly recommended. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Roger. I appreciate it. You're a great host.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.